Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the TF podcast, where we discuss technology and finance. I'm here with my next guest, Linda Jang. She has done some really interesting things in the world of law around blockchain and even with the Fed. And so I'm really excited to have a conversation with her and have you all get a chance to meet her. So with that, Linda, I'd love if you could introduce yourself, please.
Oh, hi. Thank you for inviting me. This is a real pleasure. You told me that this is, you know, going to be kind of like having lunch together, but virtually.
Yeah, definitely. We'll eat virtual food.
Yeah, so, you know, in homage to the FT lunch, I will let you know I'm having a cup of Trader Joe's Irish breakfast tea with milk.
Nice. Well, Linda, I'd love if you could tell us a little bit about yourself. You know, give us a quick little rundown of who you are and how you kind of got to where you're at.
Sure. Gosh, do you have like an hour? I feel like I've been blessed by a long but securitist yet interesting career path so far. So I'm currently the global head of policy and special counsel at Transparent Systems. Transparent is a Seattle-based fintech startup. We are developing a real-time payment and on-demand settlement solutions. And in addition to that, I'm also a senior fellow at Georgetown Law. I'm studying fintech issues, in particular open banking. So before I was focused purely on open banking and open data issues, and then I was asked by Transparent to come join them. And so now I'm immersed in crypto, blockchain, digital dollar topics that are really fun and cutting edge. So prior to Georgetown, I was at the Fed and spent probably most of my career at various financial regulators based in Washington, D.C., as well as in Basel, Switzerland, where I worked at the Financial Stability Board. So if you're interested in international and cross-border issues, you know, hit me. The regulators around the world are really curious about blockchain, and they really want to understand, you know, how can we build central bank digital currencies? So they're looking to the private sector for innovative ideas. And I have to say, this is probably the best time to work on this subject. It's so novel. There are so many, not only tech issues, but legal issues as well.
Yeah. Well, so before we get into that side of things, I'd love to understand, you know, what made you interested in being in the policy side, in the regulation side of things? Like, what drove your interest towards being, on that front when it came to like the financial and the legal profession?
Well, let's see. When I was in elementary school, I wanted to be a zoologist, and somehow that didn't happen. But fast forward to high school, I became very interested in international relations, history, and political science, and very much wanted to become a diplomat. But for some weird reason, my immigrant parents were really against me becoming a diplomat. They were afraid I was going to, you know, have to travel the world and no one would ever marry me. And so I was pressured to become a pre-med, which I really fought against. And in an act of rebellion, I went to law school.
Wow.
I was very interested in going to law school because I really felt driven by the need to be a public servant. I felt like I wanted to do something that was going to add value in my own small way to society. And so kind of in the same vein of, you know, being a diplomat, I ended up, you know, after graduating, going straight into government and went to the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, which is the bank supervisor for nationally chartered banks. And that's when I first started learning about, you know, our regulatory architecture and all the policy issues involved with our financial institutions. So from there, I ended up in Paris, where I worked for a French bank. And I got super interested in all the EU directives coming down at the moment. When I was working in Europe, the European Union was trying to put together and, you know, literally construct a single banking union. Huh. And, you know, looking back now, people call it the Big Bang for EU financial regulations. And so I got very interested in EU law. And when after getting an additional law degree, I decided, all right, I really want to work in policy now. So I moved to DC and was at the SEC. And then the crisis happened literally 8 months after I moved here. And so I decided to work on the Dodd-Frank Act at the Senate. So there I was a staffer to one of the Senate Banking Committee members.
Yeah, how was that? Refresh us real quick on the Dodd-Frank Act.
So for those who may not be familiar with the name Dodd-Frank, Dodd for Senator Dodd and Frank for Congressman Barney Frank, they were the ones who led the passage of the legislation that that attempted to reform financial regulations in response to the global financial crisis that occurred in 2008-2009. So a lot of financial regulatory framework was updated or revamped. And so it was a very exciting time to be on the Hill to, you know, get to see the sausage made.
Yeah.
And then after the Senate, I went to Treasury and worked on, you know, similar issues that we dealt with in, you know, in the passage of Dodd-Frank domestically, but on an international scale. And there I worked with regulators in the EU, Asia, and multilaterally with the Basel Committee for on Banking Supervision, the Financial Stability Board, all the international standard setters who are behind the scenes in actually setting, you know, the baseline requirements that national regulators then have to come home and try to adopt and implement. So so after Treasury, that's when I went to the Fed and worked on the first reviews of living wills of our largest banks, and did a lot of development of, you know, too big to fail agenda reform.
Yeah, I'd love to just dig deep on that. First, like what's a living will for the bank?
So part of a consequence of the 2008 crisis was that there was public backlash, of course, to bailing out the banks, especially the big banks. And so Congress, in the Dodd-Frank Act, required that banks need to develop essentially living wills for how they would die. So imagine, you know, you are planning for your own funeral, and you need to have a plan drawn out as to where would your assets go and to whom, and where are all your assets, how would they be unwound, what coffin would you like, you know, where would you like to be buried? These plans are actually very detailed. They run in the thousands of pages long, and they're required under Title II of the Dodd-Frank Act, and as well as specifically Title I. So now I'm getting way too wonky, but this was Congress's attempt to make sure that a bank can never be too big to fail, because they have a plan in place to resolve themselves.
Got it. And because before, you know, in 2008, 2009, that was essentially the narrative, that these banks were too big to fail, so they had to be bailed out because they didn't have any of these provisions in place, right?
Right. There were actually no legal tools for any of the regulators to bail out the institutions that were in trouble. If you remember, Lehman, Bear Stearns, and they were investment banks. They were not chartered and supervised by any of the bank supervisors. And they also did not have holding companies that were licensed with the Federal Reserve. So there was actually no legal, like, you know, hook for any government agency to step in. So, you know, Dodd-Frank, tried to at least give these the financial regulatory agencies tools they need if this were to occur again.
Yeah, interesting. Sorry, and then so continue. So you're helping banks stay alive, or the regulation to help them stay alive. And then what were you saying that was next? Because I know I had a question on that too.
Yeah. So so from there, I was seconded to the Financial Stability Board, which is the body that supports the G20's financial regulatory agenda. And the FSB is housed at the Bank for International Settlements in Basel, Switzerland. So it sits alongside the international standard setters, such as the Basel Committee for Banking Supervision, Committee for Payments and Markets Infrastructure, other standard setters for, you know, insurance companies, deposit insurance, and also all the economic research and market insights that the BIS pulls together for central banks. So for those who are not familiar with the BIS started off as the bank for central banks. And over time has also become the home base for a lot of the, you know, international standard setting bodies that help to, you know, set the baseline standards for the different types of financial institutions in our, you know, financial system.
Wow. Yeah. And I mean, it's interesting because, you know, as consumers, or even as, you know, people who are business owners, you hear about these things or you listen to them, you know, perhaps through the news. But yeah, you know, what was your experience in, you know, going through that process? Like, were the banks themselves open to it? Was the regulating body more driving the conversation? Like, What was that collaboration like to make it happen?
Well, it really depends on the issues. Banks already are used to being highly regulated. So the conversations with bankers, it's already in some ways fairly predictable. The priorities and agenda are generally pretty well known, and so putting forward policy, you know, so at the FSB we were trying to adopt international standard for how much banks would need to hold in terms of long-term debt that would have to be billed in if they were ever to fail. And that long-term debt would then be converted into capital and help fund the resolution of the bank. So that was the idea behind this particular requirement that's somewhat akin to capital requirements, but in the form of debt. That costs money, you know, and for banks that didn't already hold lots of long-term debt, they were, of course, very unhappy and fought hard. But because this was an idea that was already supported politically by the G20 leaders, who are the heads of states and presidents of the 20 most active economies in the world. It's a little bit more difficult for the banks to at least fight in a direct, headlong, headbutt, for example. But so the easier way for them is kind of like to then collaborate and work with the regulators.
Yeah.
So that's the sausage making process on the international level. That's actually quite similar to the domestic one. In some ways, I would say it's more functional because there's already agreement by the G20 leaders. But I'm sharing all these experiences because you're probably wondering, well, how did this, end up being relevant for a fintech startup like Transparent? Tech startups in financial services deal with a highly regulated industry. And something that I found quite interesting is that many people at fintechs are actually not very familiar with neither monetary history nor financial regulatory history. And you really need to understand both in order to help innovate in this space. And so what's been very fun about, working at a fintech startup is that, we're not only trying to develop innovative solutions for a traditional, payment system, but we're also, innovating on a policy basis and as well as on a legal basis. So, it's engineering on all fronts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Especially, when you're trying to be cutting edge and in a world where some of that policy isn't 100% defined, right? So, walk us through that process of like how does a fintech startup in a I don't want to say unregulated, but like newly regulated or like still discovering type of what regulation means, like what is that process like, and how important is it to have the proper counsel or the proper, folks involved to get you through that process?
Well, if you're dealing with the financial services industry, it's highly regulated, period. It's not about it becoming regulated, you know, or it isn't regulated. It is regulated. And that means you have to develop a product that will work and fit within the regulatory system. So you might have only, say, you know, this much room to work with, but you have to figure out how much room is there to work with. And someone with a good understanding of the financial regulatory system can probably help you gauge that space. If, you know, when you're working in a non-regulated system, then yeah, you have all the space you want. You can do anything, you know, and not have to concern about, you know, what the laws are. But in financial services, there is a reason why it's highly regulated. We're dealing with money, and these are, you know, people's assets. So it is highly sensitive, and the you know, main concern for you know, all regulators is that is stability in the financial system, that you've maintained market integrity and you protect the consumers. So the innovation that comes behind fintech firms, I often feel is more than just the tech design of the product. It's also about designing the product in a way that will fly with regulators and politicians and the community.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, a company like Transparent, which is, you know, working in the payments, you know, sector, correct, and doing those sort of things, you know, they're falling within the rules and making that their way, you know, into that market, but they also kind of have to like stick their foot in the door, right? And then you have some of these larger banks or institutions, or even larger fintechs that, you know, like PayPal's or things like that, that have been more conservative, right? And so you have like a company like Transparent that blazes the path a little bit, that then makes it feel a little bit more comfortable, say, for some of these larger fintechs to start thinking about it. Curious, like, that, what does that kind of create for Transparent, or, and then also in your experience as a regulator, like, how have you seen, I guess, the startups really, you know, creating that, I don't know, environment or that stepping stone for the broader market to get involved into a new industry, mm-hmm, or a segmented industry?
Yeah, I think, I don't know if we're that ambitious, but you know, maybe we inadvertently are that ambitious. For us, it's an opportunity to be thought leaders about topics and in a space that is still developing. And we are probably less afraid to pose questions and to present ideas about new ways to organize market participants and market infrastructure in ways that, you know, incumbents probably haven't really thought about, or at least haven't seriously thought about. And so even basic questions like, what is money, haven't been asked by many people in decades, really, since, you know, Nixon took us off the gold standard in 1971. And now this question is at the forefront of not only, you know, work at fintech startups on payment systems, but also Congress in trying to devise a digital dollar, the Fed looking at, you know, researching central bank digital currencies along with other central banks around the world. This is not an ecosystem of, you know, just tech startups or big tech companies, but also politicians and policymakers and central bankers and financial regulators. And so I think we have the opportunity to point out, hey, you know, we're actually trying to develop a digital dollar, and here are some of the issues we're running into, and, you know, let us share the lessons and observations we've garnered so far, and, you know, try to be, helpful contributor. So, going back again to the question of what is money, when you develop all these different kinds of new instruments, such as stable coins, you want them to act like money, right? But then if you examine the legal characteristics of many of these stable coins, they actually couldn't fit the definition of money, which, you know, has to have, you know, unit of account, be fungible and interchangeable. And so, in an attempt to develop, you know, stable coin like instruments that can truly act as money, we actually have to change our assumptions about what these instruments ought to be, and change language as well. So, you know, stable coins, in my opinion, is a terrible term for describing what will be, you know, digital dollar instruments, you know, in the future.
Yeah, I find the digital dollar stable coin conversation very interesting. And, you know, frankly, I just think it makes a lot of sense. It's just the digital representation of the dollar, right? Like it's just the evolution of money. And I think that's why I've been pretty interested in that. And I think there can be various representations of that digital money or, you know, so for me, I come from the retail technology space and spent a lot of time working in loyalty. And so, you know, I see a world where there's essentially all these different loyalty tokens that are digital dollars, right? Like Amazon tokens or, Walmart tokens or whatever. And it makes sense because it's within their environment. So we're not saying that these are going to be, you know, the next Bitcoin. No, like this is for a closed loop system. Instead of, you know, dealing with Visa, you deal with Amazon. And if you are an Amazon or are a Walmart and you're just building these massive ecosystems, like why wouldn't you create your own digital representation of your money? It's an evolution to, you know, reducing your fee structure and I don't want to say forcing, but encouraging people to live inside of your ecosystem.
There are lots of fundamental questions that need to be asked, and you know, in the U.S., there is no specific legal definition of money, but money, especially cash, is treated quite differently from other types of assets in commercial law. And so, you know, in developing these new types of instruments, if we want them to act truly like, you know, cash and be cash equivalent, we have to make sure that they're designed in a way that, you know, works within our legal system.
Yeah, definitely. So, I'm curious as to what your thoughts are, being a, you know, former regulator, and then what's happening now, with the this new financial crisis that doesn't always appear like a financial crisis because the stock market is roaring, but that doesn't mean that the economy is necessarily, you know, roaring either. So, you know, what type of, if you could walk us through, like, what is a process that the regulating bodies are likely going through right now in relation to what's happening? Like, are there meetings happening right now where they're saying, like, hey, because of these events, we need to start thinking about, you know, what is the process or policy for the next time something like this happens? Or how does that work?
Well, I think everyone's very busy just dealing with the current crisis.
Yeah.
So I don't know. They're even having
more mitigation.
Yeah, I don't think they have the time right now to think about how we can prevent future crises. But if you saw the Fed issued a new framework that has replaced the Taylor rule approach. So that's a really big deal for monetary policy. And then, but before we even go into that, when this crisis first occurred, it's not a financial crisis in that the problems came from within the financial system. The problems were exogenous to the system. You know, it was the COVID-19 virus, mm-hmm. and its consequences are economically astounding, and I think right away Treasury jumped on jumped into action, and the Fed followed suit right away and started pumping billions of dollars into the markets, more than they even did in the 2008 crisis. So the tools that they're using right now are very similar to the tools from the 2008 financial crisis, but the problems are not a financial system problem. They are a health crisis macroeconomic crisis. And so the financial regulatory tools that were designed in Dodd-Frank, they help in that they really shored up the capital reserves of banks, so they were in the best position possible to deal with a shock like this. But in the end, to really manage an economic crisis like this one, you have to deal with the public health problems first. So I think they're doing all they can right now. Not only is the Fed, pumping all this money into the markets and trying to keep it functioning as well as possible, to point that, it's been doing actually probably too well. I think asset prices are a little bit high, and you could see that they're sliding now. But they are also thinking towards the fact that raising interest rates in this new, post-COVID world is not going to be like raising interest rates, before COVID came. And so I think they really took it to heart and revamped their monetary policy framework, which hasn't been done in many, many years. So I have to say it's pretty revolutionary. So and it shows forethinking on the Fed's part. As for the other regulators, I mean, they're their tools are for supervising specific types of financial institutions. And again, in a crisis like this one that's driven by something outside the financial system, they can, what they can do is, help shore up the capital and operational requirements of these banks, broker dealers, investment advisors, et cetera, all the, central clearing parties, payment systems, and so they're doing, what they can, given the authorities delegated to them by Congress.
Yeah. Yeah. It's basically, keep the ship afloat, I guess. So being a former financial regulator and now like obviously very active in the space as a fellow and do you have a crystal ball? Like, does that give you like a lens that you get to see through that's a little bit different than most? Like, or you like the rest of us are kind of like, what is going on?
Well, are you asking, crystal ball as in what will our financial system look like in the future or?
Yeah. What do you, based off of like your experiences and what you've seen from the past crises to this and being at regulators, what do you see the future financial system looking like?
So, a fellow, my research is actually more on open banking and open data and what will financial systems look like in the future, what kinds of data rights would help facilitate an open data framework in the future. And so so from that lens, I see we're already becoming a data-driven, API-driven economy. And so, couple that with my former financial regulator lens, I see that, it's possible that crises in the future could be, instead of crises of liquidity in money, it would be crises in liquidity in data. So you have companies now that their sole business model is highly dependent upon customers' personal data, and in order to keep providing the services that they provide, these fintech companies need access to customer data. And so who's to say that there couldn't be a run one day when customers say, I don't want to deal with this particular company anymore because they're using my data in ways that I don't like. And I'm going to go to someone else. And this particular company could be providing services that are critical to the rest of the financial and technology system. So one day, pretty much all finance companies are going to be fintechs.
Right, yeah, you basically have to be, right? Like, yeah.
And so data is going to be the main commodity. So how would a data-driven crisis look like? I think it'd be could spend a lot of time thinking about that. How could it start and how could it spread? I think it could spread very easily once we have interoperable systems where you can easily transfer data from, one company to another company, and to consolidate them into new kinds of data sets that could be very valuable for other sets of players. But what if the customer still has control over some of, at least the initial raw data that feeds into, all these products and services? This gives, me as an academic a lot of fodder to think about, what our financial ecosystem could look like in, 10, 20 years.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see, if we make it that long. No, I'm just kidding, we will.
Or we'll probably be all living, in the woods by that point.
Yeah. In the woods, no electricity, everything, just like there's a big shockwave, no electricity. It's just, no, I'm just kidding.
But right.
It definitely feels weird. It's interesting because I don't know if it's because there's more. So the data piece that you're talking about is really interesting. I totally agree with everything you're saying there. And then along with a lot of these like data aggregation type companies are a lot of the consumer driven companies or have a lot of consumer utility, behind them, which then also you typically impact like overall buying decisions and just overall decisions that people make, right? So it's interesting because people arguably have more knowledge than ever, but there's also like swayed information. And so everything is just very polarizing and even political and that sort of thing. And so how that also affects data, it's just like this big mishmash of information and so forth.
Yeah, that's why I strongly believe that we should have a framework of data rights here in the U.S. Yeah. That can provide, common rules of the road. I am actually highly supportive of data sharing and all the, innovation that comes out of data sharing, but without at least some commonly agreed rules on how data sharing should work, you just end up with lots of car crashes. I think are one of the few developed countries that still do not have a comprehensive data rights and data protections framework. I think this is something that actually would be helpful to the fintech world rather than the other way around.
Yeah. Well, I'd love to just keep tabs and keep up to date on what you're doing with your research because I find that super fascinating. So please definitely share that along as you publish stuff or find things. I'm super interested in that.
Yep, it would be my pleasure.
Well, Linda, as we wrap up here, the question I love to ask everybody at the end of my show is this, and that is, what's a question that you have that you'd like to ask our audience that they can think about as they go about the rest of their day?
Well, what do they think Washington, D.C. can do for them to help the fintech sector? I think we have two Washingtons here up as our backgrounds.
Yeah.
But the worlds are really rather apart culturally and philosophically. And so I think the tech entrepreneurs and operators that I've had the pleasure of working with acknowledge the need to be policy savvy. I'm not sure how much they appreciate the policies coming out of Washington, D.C. And so, what messages would they like to, share with policymakers on the Hill, at Treasury Department, you know, the White House, et cetera. Developing a dialogue is always helpful.
Yeah, that makes sense. Well, Linda, what are some good ways that people can either get in touch with you or follow you or pay attention to what you're up to?
So I am terrible at managing my Twitter account, but I do have a Twitter account. It's mm-hmm. Linda Jang, LindaJeng1 at Twitter. And then I'm also on LinkedIn. And you can find me on Georgetown's Institute for International Economic Law's website.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much again for joining us. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Yeah. Everybody, thank you for watching and listening to another episode of the TF Podcast. Please do us a favor and make sure that you are subscribed to the show wherever you're listening or watching to it. As well as do us a favor and give us a review. Rating and filling in those 5 stars goes a long way. You can follow me on Twitter at JGProduct or TF Labs at TF Labs _. And to find out more about what we're doing at TF Labs, including events, you can go to tflabs.io. Thanks so much, and we'll see y'all soon.